Recording excerpted.
Afternoon. Thank you for having us again. So we're just going to do a fairly routine performance review for you this time. So last time we did the current state assessment. Later in September we'll be doing the ISD workshop. This is kind of just a regular routine review. We'll talk about the second quarter results, but more importantly we'll talk about where the markets are today and what's been happening over the past week. So why don't we start there? In the printed materials you have behind tab one is our quarterly investment landscape. And this is something that, you know, is generally focused on second quarter, so up through 6:30, and some time has passed since then. I think you're going to see some interesting insights because some of what we highlighted in here has come to fruition, and some of it probably still has to unfold. So why don't we start by taking a look at page 5. The U.S. economic summary is a good place to get a sense, put your finger on the pulse of what's going on in our economy. And on this slide at the top, we're showing GDP at 2.9%. And there have been some interesting releases come out, including the one this morning that said the second estimate of second quarter GDP is 3.7%. That's pretty nice. That was a nice revision upwards. The first estimate was 2.3%. And the first quarter GDP came in at 0.6% finalized, which was also good because the initial estimates there were negative. It looked like contraction, but it actually did grow. So, you take the good and you take the bad and you put it all together, and that first half of the year looks like we're at about 2% growth. So no surprises, just a bit of a volatile ride in getting there, and that's basically what we've been seeing all along, 2 to 3%. Inflation is the next number here, and that seems to be roughly consistent. Here we're showing zero. Latest numbers are 0.3, 0.4, depending on if you're looking at CPI and PPI and which month update, but still a very low inflationary environment. And then we'll skip down a few lines to the 10-year rate. And this one has moved since June 30th. In fact, we're showing here 2.4. It recently tested the 2 level. It came below 2 within the past week. It's now back up to about 2.17 when I checked a few minutes ago. So the 10-year Treasury has moved a lot, and that's pretty important. We're going to take a look at that in a little bit about how that number compares to some other numbers around the rest of the world. U3 unemployment, nice and low, 5.3. That's actually low by historical data. So, I mean, that's a good number to be targeting. But U6, the broader measure of unemployment, is 10.5. Now, the big issue here is that our participation rate is really low. Our participation rate, in fact, is at a 35 to 40 year low. It's 62.6%. If you look back to January of 2008, that number was about 66%. What do those 4 percentage points mean? About 10 million people left the workforce and haven't reengaged. 10 million. So that's some extra economic capacity available to help generate economic growth here in the U.S. that isn't really being engaged yet. So we take this all into consideration. We say, well, what does that mean for the Fed? The Fed has been talking for some time about trying to raise rates. And this picture looks like it seems very reasonable to do that. A zero interest rate policy is pretty drastic. It is something that has really never been used prior to the global financial crisis. We've been in it for an extended period of time, and an extended period of time where we're seeing economic growth. So we could naturally see them move off that and move 25 basis points in September. The rhetoric of the past week has softened that. And so it's interesting to see how the issues in China have now changed that temperament. And maybe it happens, but the percentage plays here have moved pretty significantly from, yeah, we really expect it to happen in September, to maybe not. We'll have to wait and see what they decide here. September 4th is the key date. And then there's also the question about December.
If you took book on that issue and charted the answer to someone on Friday or Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday, you'd have gotten 4 very different, well, Friday and Monday, you'd have gotten a similar response, which is seems less likely now, right, the raise. The last couple of days, it's, people, get back to, not jumping out of windows. They, all of a sudden, it's back in the conversation a little more today, but it seems that the volatility in the episodes have altered people's view of that interest rate timing issue.
That's right. That's exactly right. In fact, the most recently published minutes were more dovish than they have been, implying that they may not take that next step. Dudley's comments yesterday, Dallas Fed, said not necessary. Yeah. So, yeah, they're definitely softening that position. So it's interesting to watch that play out, and if it does, what impact will that have on the markets that have largely priced it in so far? So let's take a look then at page 12, because this takes a look at the international markets and what we're seeing there. We have very much a global portfolio, so let's keep these statistics in mind for some of the other countries. And page 12 does that, puts the United States up at the top, good reference point for us. But now we take a look at Europe. The ECB is well underway with their quantitative easing program. That will extend well into 2016, if not longer. And here's why. Real GDP is 1%, so they are not enjoying the economic growth that we are here. Inflation also muted, so they have room to take this fiscal monetary policy without inflationary impact, and a much higher unemployment rate. So they are also fighting this issue. Unemployment is measured in different ways around the world, so it is somewhat different, but still obviously a higher than what you would desire kind of number in Europe. Japan, also well into a stimulus program, much more stimulus relative to the size of their economy than we have here in the U.S. And so they're fighting some real headwinds there with demographics. So an aging population that's nearing retirement and purchasing less has a natural headwind to GDP growth, so it's not surprising to see some contraction there. Inflation now positive at 0.5, that's good news. They've been fighting for that. They want to see inflation, and that's part of why that market has responded so well, much lower unemployment. And then we break out the BRIC nations. And so the BRIC nations, BRIC being the acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, have often been thought of as a collective group because they had so much economic growth, so much demographic growth, so much change in the way their consumers are purchasing and acting. But you're seeing some real differences here in terms of Brazil and Russia facing dramatic headwinds. India, 5.3, some pretty good economic growth there, and China at 7%. So this is the printed number that comes out of China, very systematically comes out of China.
Am I the only one?
But that even but even
no
the
level
printed
of confidence
number.
On a Chinese number, they're just making it up.
It's interesting. Our numbers come out with a first estimate, a second estimate, a third estimate. They can be then revised a year later, and then revised one more time after that. They come out with 7%, and that's it. They're done. So they must have better statisticians than we do. Sure, they do. We'll take a look at China in a moment. As we work towards China, let's turn to page 20 because the yield curves around the world are pretty interesting too. Page 20 is a slide we used last time, and some of these yield curves have moved indeed, and some of them have moved since this time as well. So what we're showing here is major developed countries around the world, and if you look, if you're looking all the way to the right-hand side, the third line down is the U.S., call it a maroonish line, and you can see where our yield curve is. And that's indicative of a combination of things. One is on the short end, our Fed still has a zero interest rate policy. On the long end, it's more indicative of growth, longer-term growth in the U.S., and so as we see a 2 to 3% GDP growth, we're seeing a plus 3% 30-year treasury. Normally, that's even higher. But that's what it looks like in the U.S. The top line is China. And that has changed a little bit. The short end of their curve has come down because their Federal Reserve equivalent is taking economic stimulus efforts there as well. So they've brought down short-term rates. But still, a higher growth perspective and a higher yield curve. But then the rest of the curves are below that. UK is the yellow. Canada is the green. France is the lighter blue. Germany is the darker blue. And Japan at the bottom. And so when you think about should rates rise in the U.S., and everyone seems to have the consensus that we're entering a rising rate environment, but it never seems to come to fruition. Even when we get up to 2.4% 10-year, it goes back down to 2, and now we're back to 2.2. So we can't seem to really get into a higher interest rate environment. And you look around the rest of the world and you say, well, maybe it's not the case. Maybe we don't have to be in a rising rate environment. No one else is able to do it. So until we start seeing better economic growth here in the U.S., not real strong fear that we'll see a rising rate environment, even if the Fed does take an initial step in September or even a subsequent step in December. Okay, let's jump ahead next to slide 28 and equity volatility. I really like this slide because I think we talk a lot about volatility and we talk a lot about risk in the portfolio, And this is a really handy way of looking at it. Equity volatility on this slide is looking at our domestic market, the S&P 500. And in the lower left-hand side, you see volatility. This is the VIX index. You might hear that on the news and read it in the papers. It's basically a volatility index that captures the underlying metrics of the options markets. And options essentially price volatility, so we're able to get this chart. And what it shows is that volatility can be very erratic. And as of the latest print here, you can see that June 2015, the number is pretty low. But if you look at each one of these spikes over the past, it can move rapidly higher. And it tends to do so exactly in a market sell-off. So what does that tell us about VIX? It tells us VIX isn't much more than a coincidental indicator. When it moves higher, the markets are selling off. If you're looking at VIX and saying VIX is low, I should take comfort that the markets are good. That can change on a heartbeat, and that can change during the sell-off. In fact, within the past week, that number, the VIX, hit 53. We're probably at about under 20 on this page, so it can move that quickly. But it's important to keep that in mind of how fast things can move. So VIX is a coincidental indicator, which is helpful. You think about a lot of our work in terms of forecasted standard deviations and what have you, and that's sort of a backward-looking and thinking forward kind of projection. This is coincidental, so it helps to have those multiple perspectives of where we are in risk in the marketplace. So that's part of the story with equity valuations. Page 30 takes a different slice to it. And this is actual valuations looking at PE ratios. In the lower left-hand corner of this chart, we have the 12-month forward PE, which is basically saying what's our current price today against analyst estimates for the next year, the next 12 months. And here, this number, as you might have guessed, has come down a little bit. And I'm looking really at the teal-colored line for the S&P 500. And you can see that through this chart, we're currently at pretty high valuations. You have to go back to 08, 09 to be at similar valuations, or back to the 96-2000 era, which was what then-chairman Greenspan labeled irrational exuberance, so part of the dot-com era. So we're at pretty lofty levels here. Now, as of today, that number has come back. We're probably at about 16.5. So valuations have come down slightly, but guess what? Not a lot. And so if you think the recent sell-off is correction or a good buying opportunity, maybe on a short term, but keep in mind valuations are still elevated. Hasn't changed that. 32 then.
Ed, would
yes, sir.
Very low interest rates, such as we have today, have an impact on appropriate valuations vis-a-vis back in the mid-90s when we were talking about 5, 6, 7% on a short-term basis?
Absolutely. And the middle chart helps us think about that. So when we consider that we're in a low interest rate environment, shouldn't equities be worth more because of that? You're discounting future cash flows at a lower interest rate, therefore prices should be higher. The middle chart shows that that is indeed true. So what we show here is the S&P 500 dividend yield minus the 10-year Treasury yield. So the 10-year Treasury yield is kind of low. Dividend yields are relatively high in comparison. Therefore, we're actually on the high side of that as well. Or actually, this would say it's actually more normalized because the dividend yield suggests a lower price. So this would temper that, John, to your point, and say, in interest rate environment, it's not crazy to be at these valuations. It is from a historical perspective. It's not from an interest rate perspective.
That then takes us, of course, to your projection that we want to make sure we get on tape about where interest rates are going as soon as we get that straightened away at the Fed.
We'll tell you when they rise.
We'll hold that for a little bit longer. 32 takes a similar look at international equity markets, looking at valuations here. In the lower left-hand side, we're looking at the top line. The dark blue is EFA, or the developed markets, Europe, Australasia, and Far East. The middle teal-colored line on this chart is the ACWI, all-country world, except for U.S., And then the bottom is emerging markets. And the emerging markets is interesting. They've certainly sold off as well as we have here in the U.S. And you look at this and you say, well, valuations in emerging markets aren't as stretched to begin with. And we know that equity, emerging market equities are volatile. We'll take a look at that in a little bit too. They can be quite volatile. But with valuations this low, that looks like one of the better equity investment opportunities ahead for us today. Although it's going to be a volatile ride for sure. Okay. Now let's skip ahead to China on 36. China has been going through a lot of changes, and part of it is how they regulate and manage their stock market. Those changes have been taking place over the past couple weeks. That has had a significant impact in the buying and selling. Part of it has been the growth or lack thereof of the Chinese economy, and their decision to devalue the currency last week, Monday of last week. And this is an interesting chart in the lower right-hand corner that helps us understand why, because here we're plotting out in orange the Chinese real GDP, so basically this printed 7% that they're capable of producing. The blue line, however, is the Li Keqiang Index. Apologies, I'm sure I mispronounced the premier's name, but the premier of China uses this index as an indicator of economic growth. And it's a composite of three pieces. One is railway cargo, one is bank lending, and one is energy consumption. And by using those three metrics, that's how he gauges what's going on in the Chinese economy. And right or wrong, it's another proxy for economic growth there, and you can see how much that has come off. So there's been a lot of talk in the markets about China's not really producing a 7% return or GDP growth. So there's always been the speculation that China isn't that strong. We've seen managers move away from their positioning in Chinese stocks because of that. So now seeing this and seeing what's happened in the past couple weeks, it's kind of like, well, no surprise. The decision by China to devalue its currency, or more accurately, to make its currency more market-based is interesting. This is something the U.S. has long lobbied for, with that for years we thought the yuan was over, or should have appreciated relative to where it was, that China intervention was keeping it lower than it should be, and that was hurting our exports to them. Allowing it to trade freely now allows it to devalue, because they had it pegged to the dollar, basically. It devalues, allowing their exports to be cheaper to the rest of the world. Our exports to them are now more expensive, and we're upset about it. Well, you know, it's kind of, you get what you ask for, or be careful, you get what you ask for. So this is one of those situations where indeed they start to do it. So long term, it's probably a good thing. Allowing it to be more market-based allows it to be more dynamic and reflect the actual investor market community view of what's going on in China rather than their federal intervention.
By the way, just a fun fact for cocktail chatter, the renminbi and the yuan. You've probably heard of those two things when talking about Chinese currency. So we have a currency, the dollar, and then we have a unit of currency, also the dollar. The British system has a currency, the British sterling, and a unit of currency, the British pound, right? So China is like that. They have the currency, the renminbi, and then the unit of currency, the yuan. So they're sort of interchangeable, but if you can't pay somebody back in renminbis, you got to pay them back in yuans. But when talking about Chinese currency, you can use either one.
And I can only pronounce yuan, so.
Okay. And so we go.
Page 44, I'll wrap up here. We have the periodic table of returns, always an interesting chart, and very similar to what we showed you last time. I just want to use this chart this time to highlight the emerging markets volatility. So if you pick out, say, the 2003 column, the top number there in that kind of reddish-colored box is 56.3. That's the annualized return in 2003 for emerging market equities. And you can see what it did, 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, just a terrific run. 2008, the very bottom, gave it half back. 2009, nice return. So it's an interesting asset class, but it tends to sit on the tops and the bottoms because it is so volatile. So when we talk about investing in emerging markets because there's a valuation story there, we also have to be careful about how we do it, when we do it, and who's managing. So let me pause there for any questions or thoughts. I can roll into the portfolio review next.
One question I have, that's the right point. What, how does the presidential election every 4 years, what kind of impact does that have? Is something measuring just...
I've seen analyses on that. You've probably seen them as well in terms of like what year of a presidential term is good for investing versus bad for investing in U.S. stocks. And it's not foolproof, but it is interesting and it kind of makes sense in terms of a president coming into office offers new blood, new ideas. People are optimistic about that typically. Second year tends to be hit with the reality of working with a Congress or something. Third year starts to gear up. Yeah, and gearing up for the next election, what have you. But we don't really incorporate that much into it. In fact, our analysis is very heavy on the economic side, not heavy on the political side.
Which ones are going which way? I think this one's going that way.
Between them. Should we go into the performance report?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, tab two. So a couple changes. The first page behind tab two, you're seeing an executive summary. So this was a request we received during our trustee interviews. This was something very helpful in the past, so we tried to create something similar for you. Certainly welcome feedback. If you have any questions or concerns about that, that is something we can definitely edit. Page two has the cash reconciliation or market value reconciliation, beginning the market value reported at 7.2 billion. Withdrawals only partially offset by investment earnings, so ending the quarter at 7.1 billion. Page three has the mountain chart in terms of the growth of the assets in the portfolio and showing the net cash outflows. So this is really a nice measure of success of the plan in terms of growing assets while paying benefit payments. On the right-hand side, we have the asset allocation history. Certainly some more work that we'll be doing there during the ISD. On page four, we have the quick checklist in terms of making sure that our allocations within the portfolio are consistent with the investment policy statement. You're seeing all yeses in the right-hand column there, so that's good news. All of those check. And then getting into the performance itself on page five, we have a couple of interesting changes here. First, on the right-hand side, we have an attribution chart. And this chart is taking the attribution of 3 months, the second quarter results, against the CPI plus four benchmark. And this was a suggestion from our last meeting. We were previously doing it against policy index. And when you do it against policy index, you tend to see that most of the decisions are really about selection. You can't really see how much your decisions to allocate to different asset classes are represented. So this chart does that. It's a short time period, though. And so we're working on, you know, thinking of long-term pension plan management. This is showing 3 month, and the following page shows 1 year. Both of them are relatively short-term. But it does give you a sense about how the asset allocation decisions are made and what impact they're having versus the gray, which is capturing the selection effect or manager selection within the asset classes to generate returns. On the left-hand side, you can see the performance numbers, gross of fees, which we use for comparison against other public plans. We're showing 0.3% for the quarter against a policy index that was negative 4. CPI plus 4 is 2.1. So investor force rank within the public funds came down from the first percentile we're used to seeing to 56th. So basically median performance for the quartile. Longer time frames are still very strong. We'll get into the individual managers and strategies in a moment. And pages 7 and 8 then show the same results on a net of fees basis. Total fund doing 0.2% for the quarter and 3.7 year to date. Page 9, showing your risk return. I like this slide. I like it because whenever you do an asset allocation study, you create that risk return numbers, and we present those and work through them. And this is kind of a check on how are we doing with it. So your asset allocation study that was last done in June of 2011 selected an asset allocation that was designed to generate 7.85% with an annualized standard deviation of 13.6. And here you can see that your actual annualized return over the past 5 years is 12.35%, so much higher than the expected return. with a much lower standard deviation, 7.9 versus 13.6. So this is kind of a proof is in the pudding kind of slide for us. Slide 10, taking a look and just highlighting some of the managers with notable performance. Intech, large cap core, so Intech's domestic equity product underperformed 2.6% and ranked in the 98th percentile. And this was really due to its holdings in utilities and industrials and materials, all three of which were underperforming sectors for the quarter. Very defensive, and defensive wasn't the place to be. Looking down through this list a little bit further, Emerald Advisors was in the 5th percentile. Nice results there at 6.7%, overweight technology and financials, and some selection in healthcare. Hereford International Equity at the bottom of the page, 95th percentile. Part of this was due to selection in Japan. So it is underweight Japan, and Japan had a very strong quarter. It has 8% emerging market exposure, so part of it was that. And also, it is very underweight financials by about 31%. They don't like banks, so banks were a better place to be during the quarter.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Hereford.
Perfect.
Yeah, bottom of page 10. A couple other noteworthy ones as we get onto page 11 under total global equity. We see Artisan had a nice quarter, ranking in the 3rd percentile. Overweight investment technology big time, which was very helpful. Also some stock selection in healthcare. They're about 57% US and about 10% emerging markets, so that we are getting some emerging markets exposure there as well. A couple down from there, Intech, the same story on their global strategy. Some of the overweight to utilities was detrimental to performance. Fixed income, nothing particularly noteworthy across fixed income. Similarly with inflation hedge, real estate, Adelante. So I'm on to page 12, the bottom of page 12, Adelante. Actually outperformed the Wilshire REIT index, but was still down 9.4% for the quarter. So a difficult time for REITs in general. Had some manufactured housing and storage exposure that helped it. We can flip ahead a few pages to slide 16. So this is the performance and progress reporting in terms of the closed-end funds. So this is page 16 is really designed to show how the capital is being called and committed. So this is very standard minor changes from last quarter. And you're not seeing the Angelo Gordon Energy Fund on here yet. That's probably a third, maybe into fourth quarter funding. Similarly, Common Fund was another strategy that you approved that isn't showing up here yet, but will once it gets actual capital committed to it. Page 17 is the private equities. So again, here is where we would expect to see pathway. I'm sorry, this is real estate on 17. 18 is the private equities where we would see pathway 8.
Stop for just a second. This may be more of a question for Tim. It would seem to me that we're now reaching that sweet spot for the Angelo Gordon Fund. Distressed, producers and whatnot. Is there activity that is anticipated there?
They have called capital. They have made two investments thus far. They're working on a number right now. We're still working through legal documentation. We're hoping to make the next close in a couple weeks here. But yeah, part of this is the opportunity set. We were there at the end of July. Oil was at $48. It's $39, $40 today. So yeah, the opportunity set got better.
Right.
We are currently, the board approved a range of allocations. We're working through internally whether we want to move off that $75 million level to a higher dollar amount. That's still with my team, and we're still on legal documentation. But if we move on that, we'll bring that back to the board or let you know what we do.
And another on that page, I just need to have my memory refreshed about Hearthstone. Why those numbers come out looking like that, negative market value and
The assets are gone, some liabilities remain, and they're getting cleaned up.
Okay, all right. I'd like to see any market value.
Always under the de minimis.
Hate to see a market value with a minus in front of it.
It sounds like 2008.
The sounds like Nagawa.
The assets have been gone for a long time.
Do you have any time frame, Tim, in terms of when you'd guess that would be cleaned up?
Hearthstone 1, we're looking at next year to be cleaned up. Hearthstone 2 could potentially go to 2022 at the site side if all legal extensions are executed.
Okay. But to go across that line again for Hearthstone, you're saying cleanup, basically they're winding it down, but it still shows a $5 million commitment.
Hearthstone 2. With the route side, their investment period, so they can't actually call that.
Wait a minute. So it has an asterisk? It's a commitment that they can't call? Should be a different column?
The commitment is callable during the investment period. Once you're outside the investment period, which is usually 3 years, any uncalled capital is off the table.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, that's probably just my memory, but I wouldn't have known that when I saw that. It looks like they still have access to that.
Excellent feedback for Barris.
Okay.
Pen in hand.
Put a quill on the head.
Pen writing. Okay. Good. Thank you.
That's true for Long Wharf 2 also. So same. We're outside the commitment period there. So there's $33 million that is unreachable.
There's no remaining.
No, they've used 33.
Yeah. They've distributed 30.
Oh, I'm sorry. I read the wrong column. Okay. Ignore that. See, I should have quit while I was ahead.
Yeah. Just like professional.
I know the Barris team is working on a better way of displaying some of this data so we can take some of those suggestions back.
Smaller font, what were you thinking?
That was my preference.
we're going to reduce the
absolutely
font.
You could just put the Hearthstone on a remaining commitment, not really, or something different.
Not really.
We'll work on the obfuscation.
The last thing I want to highlight within the performance report is just an interesting factoid as you flip through. If you turn to page 27, for example, we have rolling performance charts for most of the managers. And what you see on 27 is a rolling 3-year and a rolling 5-year annualized returns. And we're showing the manager against its representative index. And what's interesting is rolling 3-year and rolling 5-year are helpful in thinking through the cyclicality of an investment strategy, both in terms of the business cycle, the market cycle. You would expect the S&P 500 to have highs and lows over time, and the managers, active managers, tend to have periods of outperformance, underperformance. And so this is a way of showing that. Sometimes a manager goes through a period of underperformance. You look at this and say, they've done this before, or you know, maybe now's not the time we want to pull a trigger, or whatever. There are lots of different discussions. But what you notice in this report is that as you flip through page after page after page, all your managers are doing really well. Like, they are all very high on the 3-year numbers for the ones that we have 3-year numbers for. So it's a pretty strong performance across the board.
Ed, I noticed you use a different standard for on the vertical side. If you look at the 5-year rolling, it's 10-5, 0-5, 10-15. If you look at the 3-year, it's 30-20-10.
Yeah.
reason for doing that as opposed to having a common vertical?
It's just auto-sized to try to fit the data to the graph. So it's just automatically scaling it. I think you're right, though. It's something that you have to always pick up on in terms of...
You don't recognize that they look a lot more similar than they would if you used the same comparative measurement.
These two probably would not change that much, would they? I will ask. I'll see what, anyway, what they say.
I thought.
Tab 3 has the risk dashboard. And we continue to improve upon this as well, so we would expect to see some additional improvement. But I wanted to highlight a couple interesting things about it. One is when you take a look at the first chart here, labeled number one, portfolio risk, we're seeing that the portfolio risk is 7.2%. We just saw earlier in the report that the five-year annualized standard deviation was 7.9. So these two kind of jog. 7.2 and 7.9 aren't far apart. But this is significantly lower than what your asset allocation study again was in terms of it being 13.6. So you think about that and you say, well, if we were willing to accept 13.6, but we're really only getting 7.2, should we be doing something different? We don't think necessarily so, but it's something to consider. And as you move, or as you think about moving to incorporate more risk into the governance and decision making of the portfolio, this is something that can be informative. That 13.6 was likely a 10-year number. Most investment consultants use a 10-year number, so chances are when Milliman did it, that's what they were looking at. 7.2 is what MSCI's Borrow One tool captures, and it uses a long tail in terms of it captures a lot of the history, but a lot of that history is weighted very light. It's weighted more heavily the more current you get. And so it's really more like a three-year volatility number. So what you're seeing in the markets over the past 3 years has indeed been pretty tranquil, pretty up and consistent markets. And so when we're looking at 7.2, that's what we're seeing. We haven't seen the choppiness yet. So interesting number there. Slide two, portfolio equity beta. This is showing your total portfolio, which includes fixed income and all of the assets. So showing that your portfolio's sensitivity to the equity markets globally is a little bit north of 0.5, 0.54. And then slide three, which goes on to page two, your interest rate risk, your duration, which is the sensitivity of the total portfolio to a 1% change in rates, is 1.5. So in general, when we look at your portfolio and say, what if rates rise? This would say that you would expect your portfolio value to decrease, but not by a lot. 1.5 is a pretty low number on that scale.
Questions on those two slides. I really like the dashboard. I mean, I realize it's a flash, but I want to know what I'm supposed to conclude from that. If you see that kind of deflection, if you will, from our policy versus our portfolio, is that a good deflection in this case? It means we're less sensitive, or we should revisit our policy and make it lower?
So there's a couple of things here. One is it's important to note that the dashboard that you're looking at is it compares your policy index from your benchmarks to your portfolio allocation using benchmarks. Right, so it's not grabbing the underlying securities that are actually in your portfolio. It's an index level analysis. So you would expect them to be pretty close based on that. This captures differences between your asset allocation and the policy allocation, essentially. So what you should conclude is, are we taking the risk that we signed up for when we set up our investment strategy? So you get a sense of, okay, the policy
tells me we're taking less risk.
That's right. So somewhat less risk than you signed up for. But these aren't big variances. Yeah, no.
How about the next one, though? I was more interested in the fact that the credit risk for an average pension is zero.
Yeah. And that is a measurement issue that we're sort of wrestling with. So it takes those indexes and it doesn't break out, so for fixed income, right, the Barclays Ag, it doesn't break out rate risk and credit risk and put them into separate buckets. For the portfolio that you have, it's mostly in rate risk and not in credit risk. So we're continuing to try and refine that and get a better.
So this one really doesn't tell me much of anything. Okay. I don't know what it tells you guys, but.
No, I wanted to ask what it meant.
That's right. I just don't know what it means.
I understand, well, I'm familiar with the interest rate risk duration concept. I've never seen credit risk, and I assume credit risk would be zero with treasuries, and you'd have credit risk based upon investment-grade bonds, portion in the portfolio that are not investment-grade and over investment-grade and obviously moving up the investment-grade ladder. So somebody actually makes that kind of calculation on a bond portfolio?
Yeah, and in essence, this is because we have exposure to high yield. And so it's treating the high yield allocation and using the Merrill Lynch High Yield Index as the measure for this credit spread duration. So it's saying because we have an allocation there and because high yield has that spread it component to it, as you're saying. Yeah. That's what it's capturing.
It's proportional, I assume, though, to the entire holdings, not...
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
And in fact, therefore, it probably understates it when you think about
right. You
do have credit embedded in your other fixed income managers that's not being captured here, that this is only capturing the high yield component. You do have more than what's being shown here.
So if credit spreads were to blow out, spread duration is not a good indication of how much...
The expected losses should be greater.
Right.
Okay.
We're still working on that.
Okay.
And in general, I think this is kind of good fodder for the workshop. When we think about what should the portfolio duration be, what's an acceptable number, what isn't, that'll be an interesting discussion to think about those implications. If you think about a corporate plan that was interested in fully hedging its liabilities and doing this liability-driven investing, it would want to have a duration much higher because they know their liabilities are much higher, so they would try to match those. That's not what we're trying to do here. And so we're trying to think about how we fulfill the payments to the beneficiaries appropriately, but we want to have a portfolio that's capable of growing, not just hedging our liabilities. And because of that, we're willing to take on much lower duration risk in acceptance of equity beta and portfolio risk in general.
I like the questions, though, because we want to get you guys familiar with the risk dashboard. Because over time, we want to spend more time looking at the risk dashboard and making sure that you're on track and using it to help in investments.
And to use a ridiculous example, if you're quickly looking at a dashboard on a car and you've got a gauge without any indications on it, but just a needle, if the needle's pointing full to the left, I may or may not be concerned until somebody tells me full left means empty.
Right.
And I don't know. So if it doesn't have some kind of relative
right. Quarter,
half full.
You know. Or your odometer cables have been removed.
Or with your I was talking about the fuel.
Oh, you were talking fuel.
It's even worse if it's an altimeter and it says zero and you thought you were 5,000 feet.
By the way, the cable has disappeared years ago.
Long gone.
The metric is what did we sign up for? So that's the policy, right? That's the risk we signed up for. And then, if you get down to the security level, it gives you a more accurate reading of where you are relative to the risk you signed up for, because it takes all the underlying securities in your portfolio and uses those rather than just the...
But also having a comparison for the other pension funds is an interesting comparison. At least it tells you where you are. You may or may not be happy there, but if you're 50% one way or the other, you might wonder why.
Mm-hmm.
And want to revalidate that that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. That's it, right? It's supposed to raise questions and, you know, almost a variance analysis. Okay.
I'll hold this for the 2 days.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes our report.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Again, I might say personally, I'm very impressed with the way this is set up and laid out. I absolutely like it.
Great.
Any trustee additional questions?
I was going to say, I like the way you go smoothly through it. You don't go page by page and read. I like where you're hitting the points. It makes it more engaging for me.
Good. This was actually a much longer review of the markets than I typically do. I think it's interesting. I think we're kind of at a different perspective now. It seemed like for so long we were saying, we're continuing on. Now it's looking like valuations are pretty full. Where do you invest? How do you position a portfolio against this? And, you know, sort of be forewarned that we could be in a lower return environment coming up. So
pretty choppy for a while. It's just, you know, the recent volatility was extraordinary, but it's been pretty ugly for 15 overall equities.
For 2015?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
I think Tim steps in for. Any other trustee questions first?
That's great.
If not, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.